Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome back to the New Books Network. I am your host, Stephen Dozman. Gramsci's concept of hegemony is often invoked, but usually as a means of cultural critique and analysis. However, my guest, Lorenzo Fusaro, argues in his recent book, Crises and Hegemonic Transitions, that Gramsci's work is permeated by Marx's economic critique and his theories of value. Split into two parts, the book is both a critical rereading of Gramsci, followed by a rereading of the last century of economic and political developments. The first half of the book involves a careful rereading of the key concepts in Gramsci's prison notebooks, rethinking concepts such as hegemony as being more closely related to the base instead of simply being superstructural description. Hegemony is not above and beyond economic dynamics and antagonisms, but emerges from them and changes alongside them. This allows for a broadening of the theory conceptually, and also allows him to apply it to international relations, instead of being confined to a particular state. The second half of the book then traces the economic history of the 20th century, starting with the rise of the United States in the international scene in the 1920s, and following through to its eventual unraveling on the world stage in the present day. And even though the book was first published in 2018, at the end, Fusaro offered some speculations on how this reworked theory of hegemony might help us think about the recent COVID crisis and its aftermath. Synthesizing theory, history, and economics, this is a book that offers a powerful punch and will reward readers from a number of different angles, and offers some dynamic theoretical resources for understanding our current crisis and what might be just around the corner. Lorenzo Fusaro received his PhD in International Political Economy at King's College London. He is an associate professor of political economy at the Universidad Autónoma Metropolitana in Mexico, and is also one of the editors of the recently published Revisiting Gramsci's Laboratory. Lorenzo Fusaro, welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello. Many thanks for giving me this opportunity to present my book, and thanks to all the listeners.
Yeah, so to kick things off, we always like to have guests introduce themselves at the beginning. So could you maybe tell listeners a bit about your background and what your work and research tends to focus on?
Well, at the moment, I'm an associate professor of political economy at the Universidad Autónoma Metropolitana in Mexico City. And I mainly work on Marx. I teach capital, political economy, but also I have worked quite a bit on Gramsci. When the book we are going to discuss is one of the work I have written on him, and moreover. Most recently, jointly with other persons, I have published another book called Revisiting Gramsci's Notebooks.
Wonderful. So to kick things off, your book is in large part an attempt to synthesize Gramsci's theory of hegemony with Marx's critique of political economy. So before we get to your approach to hegemony and economy, can you maybe give listeners a sense of how this sets your reading of Gramsci apart from other readings that have dominated in the last few decades? Particularly, I see him usually brought up as a sort of cultural theorist or literary critic. You're trying to bring him more towards economics. Can you maybe speak to that a bit?
Yeah, I mean, if in every crisis there is a lot of talk about hegemony or hegemonic transitions, crisis of hegemony, and of course, one of the main reference point or person who has developed or theoretician that has developed the concept of hegemony is Gramsci. So many analyses coming from international or critical international political economy are based on Gramsci. And I can mention, for example, world system theory or neo-Gramscian analysis. And basically, what I attempt to do is to offer a friendly critique of these approaches, mainly because I believe that they attempt to transpose concepts with that Gramsci actually developed for the analysis of the national situation to the international. Okay, that's one problem they have. They, most of the time, although they are, we have critical theories, they detach themselves from the main tenets of Marx's Capital. Okay, so what I attempt to do and my reading of Gramsci tries to underline this relation between Marx's Capital and Gramsci's main work, The Prison Notebooks. I try to show that although The Prison Notebooks are mainly understood as a work on the superstructure, the ideology, also the state, and so on. I believe that the law of value and the main critique of political economy that Marx develops is very important for understanding all the main Gramscian concepts and the main narratives he is developing in his main book. And in order to do that, I care to go back to the critical edition of Gramsci's notebooks, which of course is in Italian. And so but that's one. Those are some of the main differences I have with other interpretations.
Yeah, moving into the book. So in looking at various ways of using hegemony to study economic transitions, you say a good starting point for this would be what you call hegemonic stability theory. Can you give us a sense of what this theory is and how it helps us think of the economic transitions Marx has outlined regarding the transition from cooperative to competitive production?
Yes, I mean, hegemonic stability theory is the sort of mainstream theory of hegemony. And what it says is basically that it's, in order for the capitalist economy to function, it's necessary to have a hegemonic power. Actually, I mean, if you look a bit at the history of this theory, you have an important work by Charles Kindleberger, and then Robert Gilpin, who exactly underlined this point, no? That the necessity to have a hegemonic power. And therefore, you have a sort of positive connotation when you analyze hegemony from that perspective. And you could also even speak of a benevolent hegemon and so on. And I say that this is a starting point if you want to criticize or to look critically at hegemony, using, for example, the work of Giovanni Arrighi. Okay, and Giovanni Arrighi, he maintains that, drawing on Gramsci, that a state becomes hegemonic when it can credibly claim to be a motor force of a general expansion. What does this mean? It means that basically Arrighi is looking at this critically, no? Saying if a state wants to be hegemonic, it needs basically to convince other allied states or subordinated states that it's in their interest to have this particular country as a hegemonic country. Whilst in hegemonic, with the theory of hegemonic stability, you have a position which is completely different. There they say that it's necessary to have a hegemonic power. So this is why I speak or I say that it's a good point to start with. Yeah.
So working towards your understanding of Gramsci, you bring up his theory of the state, which you describe as being what you call an integral state, involving a dialectical relationship between a couple different spheres that work together to educate citizens. Can you unpack this a bit?
Yeah, I mean, the integral state is something that is very important in Gramsci's writings, and that I somehow also use when I attempt to theorize or to re-theorize hegemony at the international level. And it's important because Gramsci was asking himself, well, why are we having a revolution in the East and whilst in the West we have, for example, fascism coming up, no, and so on. And so one of the main arguments is that the integral state, as you mentioned as well, understood as the dialectical unity between political society and civil society, is actually something that enables that in a situation in which you have a major crisis, the system does not collapse. Okay, so I use that element or this idea also when I try to theorize hegemony at international level, because even there it's not said that in times of crisis you automatically have a crisis of hegemony or a hegemonic transition. This is what I would answer.
So from here you turn, you were just mentioning crisis. So from here you go to Marx and try and synthesize Gramsci and Marx together, particularly the Marx of Das Kapital, with particular focus on the contradictions engendered by value and surplus value on the capitalist system as a whole, and how it leads to a tendency for the rate of profit to fall over time. Can you maybe give us a sense of how contradictions function in Marx's theory of capital and how this fits within your reading of Gramsci?
Well, the question of contradiction in Marx's Capital is a very big theme, no? And there are lots of works that try to figure out how that works. There are different opinions about that. What I attempt to do, and the way in which I take into consideration the contradictory character of capitalist accumulation and the different contradictions that Marx outlines in Capital, is to build what I refer to as an organic theory of crisis. No? And there I associate different contradictions between, for example, between production and consumption, between production and exchange, to different so-called monocausal crisis theories. For example, the theory of underconsumption or overproduction, or another important theory of financialization, and so on. And I look at it, say, a bit differently. I try to find a way to articulate all these different crisis theories. And in doing so, I mainly try to read Capital from a Gramscian perspective, no? Where, again, contradictions are very important. We mentioned and contradictions, and also what Gramsci calls organic unities. Organic unities are like concepts made up of two different contradictory elements, no? Like consensus and coercion, or civil society and political society. And the same we might also apply when analyzing these different contradictions or concepts in Capital. As I mentioned, production and consumption, production and exchange, and so on. And the basic idea behind all of that is that through capitalist accumulation, the search for more and more surplus value, there is a tendency for these different parts that are that compose an organic unity to separate itself from one another. So, for example, in the case of financialization, where the fear of exchange outgrows, okay, and detaches itself from production, or the same when you talk about production and consumption, okay, also there. You have this separation between these two elements. And so the idea is that you have, as capitalism progresses, you have this increasing detachment between this, these different parts. But also there, it's not said that this would lead automatically to a crisis. So the question is, when do you have the situation in which a possibility of crisis turns it into an actual crisis? And there I integrate the question of profitability. Okay, you mentioned the law of the tendency of the rate of profit to fall. And I introduce it in order to attempt to say, okay, this detachment between, again, for example, production and exchange is not problematic in as far as profitability is enough to sustain this separation. A concrete example: if the stock market or finance is growing exponentially and so on, and production is and profitability is as well, then you don't have a problem of financing, say, this increase in the financial markets. But when profitability doesn't grow as fast relative to this to finance and so on, then you have a problem, and you have also an increased probability that it will turn actually into a crisis, a concrete crisis. So this is the way in which I try to articulate all these different contradictions in order to build an organic theory of crisis.
Yeah, developing this a little more, often discussion about hegemony and contradiction happens as if it only exists within a state or within certain national borders. But you argue that there's an international theory of hegemony, both with how hegemony is imposed and enforced, and how contradictions can function at the international level. Can you unpack this a little bit for us?
Yes, many thanks for this question. As I said at the beginning, I attempt to reread Gramsci and to offer a new way of analyzing hegemony or hegemony at the international level, while funding it basically in Marx's Capital. And there, I mean, the starting point is to see that Gramsci had a dialectical, one might say, analysis of international relations. So he was never analyzing a nation on its own. Okay, he always said, okay, if you want to analyze one single nation, you have to always take into account the influence that other nations are giving to specific developments in the country or nation or state you want to analyze. Okay. At the same time, these different nations these different nations are not equal. Okay, he breaks with this idea of sovereignty or equal sovereignty amongst different, comparing different national states, and there you have a hierarchy between between states, and a hegemonic state in that sense is comprehended as a state that has what I finally call a relative geopolitical autonomy. That means that they can hegemonic state can take decisions in a relative autonomous way, and other states, subordinated states, will feel the influence of a hegemonic state. For example, I mean, I live, say, in Mexico, and the decisions that the United States take have a strong impact on what will happen in Mexico. What the Federal Reserve decides, etc., has a big impact on Mexico, but not the other way around. Okay, so moreover, in order to reach this relative geopolitical autonomy or hegemony, you cannot look simply at say economic the economic performance, economic indicators, and so on. You have also to analyze the political element as well as finally the military element. So you have to take into account both, say, the consensual aspect of power, but also the coercive aspect of power in order to analyze hegemony at the international level. With this, I refer also to a bit to one of the previous questions regarding, say, my reading of Gramsci. It's important to underline that a crisis, an economic crisis, doesn't need to transform itself into a crisis of hegemony. I mean, it can, but it's not necessarily the case. And it's exactly taking into account this aspect economic, political, and I would say also military power that enables you to say, okay, so we have a crisis, but a hegemonic state has the possibility to react to that crisis using the power, economic, political, and military power. Okay, whilst other analysis of hegemony usually say, okay, we have a decline in GDP compared to other countries, trade is declining, and so on, and that is interpreted already as a crisis of hegemony or even a hegemonic transition. So I try to avoid that sort of determinist or economistic reading. So this is the way in which I would answer your question.
Yeah, so that brings us through the first half of the book where you do kind of a lot of theoretical development. The second half is, it turns into something of a history book. So you start with the U.S.'s rise to hegemonic power, where it made a slow but steady ascent, which came to full fruition in the 1920s. Can you explain this history and how your theory of hegemony that you've been developing helps us understand and rethink this history?
Yeah. Thanks for this question. There is, of course, a debate, no, and different historical analysis on the rise of the United States to hegemony at the international level. And most analysis actually say that the U.S. became hegemonic only after World War II, okay? And what I'm attempting to argue in that first historical chapter of the book is that the U.S. actually became hegemonic already during the interwar period, after, let's say, after World War I, with an important qualification. I was saying that, okay, hegemony has, at the international level, includes the economic, political, and military moment. There are also situations in which a country tries to be hegemonic without having achieved what I refer to as a completely realized hegemony. And I argue that, okay, the United States fully realizes hegemony after World War II, that's correct, but after World War I, they have like a weaker form of hegemony that I refer to as Sturm und Drang hegemony. And it's a weaker form of hegemony because, indeed, in that case, it's mainly based on its economic supremacy. There are some political elements, but it's not the sort of hegemony that would the United States would construct through World War II and after World War II.
Mm-hmm. Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
The economic crash in the late 1920s, followed by a decade of economic depression, is often seen as unrepresentative of the contradictions of capital that Marx described. And you quote him thus: "Instead of investigating the nature of the conflicting elements which erupt in the catastrophe, the apologists content themselves with denying the catastrophe itself and insisting, in the face of their regular periodic recurrence, that if production were carried on according to the textbook, crises would never occur." In contrast to this apologetic tone, you offer a fairly detailed Marxist analysis of this crisis. Can you maybe give us a summary of that?
Yes. Basically, I mean, that quote is interesting, and I think it's a very pertinent quote, not just for the Great Depression, but for major or for crisis in general, no? Because differently from, say, neoclassical economics and other strands within economics theory, where crises are mainly determined exogenously, in Marx they are created by the very contradictions that build up in capitalism. No? So you have this strong contrast between the mainstream view and the Marxist view. And within Marxism, as I was mentioning before, you have different interpretations. Now, before, when speaking more theoretically, I attempted to mention so some of the main strands within Marxist crisis theory. You know, as I mentioned, underconsumption, overproduction, and crisis theory that emphasize the role of finance, and as well the rate. The law of the tendency of the rate of profit to fall. Again, what I attempt to do is to integrate these different crisis theories. So I'm not dismissing, say, the underconsumptionist theory proposed by Hobsbawm or those which are based more on the question of finance, which actually don't need to be necessarily Marxist, and so on. So I say, okay, both these elements were present. Okay, on the one hand, this idea of growing inequality, wages that were not rising as fast as before compared to production, the increase of the financial sphere, etc. I don't deny the existence of all of that. Those are important elements, okay? But at the same time, we need to ask ourselves, when do these problems, or as we said before, these contradictions which are building there, turn into an actual crisis? And there is where I draw on the problem of profitability. No? And there you have also analysis, for example, by Dumenil and Levy, who show how profitability was basically declining. So with declining profitability, it's difficult to pay off, say, dividends and so on, which are necessary to maintain the financial sphere as it was, or a growing financial sphere, or to pay off debts, etc., that are building up. At the same time, lower profitability means that wages won't rise, etc. So you have also this issue of underconsumption that can manifest itself, no? And so this is the way in which I attempt also in this case to integrate these different crisis theories and analysis and actual analysis of crisis, of the Great Depression in this case.
Right. Turning to some of the effects of the crisis, you argue that the hegemonic authority the U.S. had achieved in previous decades started to unravel here, and you even posit September 1931 as the symbolic start date for this unraveling. Can you unpack how the old hegemony came to an end in this time period?
Yeah, as I mentioned before, I start from the idea that this form of hegemony that the United States constructed in the interwar period was a weak form of hegemony. And this is why, I believe, the Great Depression effectively led to a crisis of U.S. hegemony. And I understand a crisis of hegemony or of world hegemony when other states are able to construct hegemonic relations, at least regionally. Okay, so the emergence of competitors and states that are able to construct hegemonic relations on their own are a manifestation of a crisis of world hegemony. And I believe that this happened basically during the Great Depression. So the main pillars upon which U.S. or this weak form of U.S. hegemony rested started to crumble, no, or to collapse. I mean, you can look at income, GDP, trade, but also, for example, the control of the monetary system, no, which the U.S. constructed after World War One. Also, several agreements that the U.S. Made after the war started to be void. No, okay. So you have German rearmament. You have Japan invading Manchuria. So there are different elements that point that the sort of hegemony the U.S. constructed after World War One basically collapsed, and this is why I speak of a first crisis of U.S. hegemony during that period.
Yeah, moving forward historically a few years, in the wake of the Second World War, the U.S. emerged as the central hegemonic force in the world. But you argue that this wasn't simply a reassertion of the hegemony achieved before the Great Depression, but was a fundamentally new form of connection and control. Can you tell us a bit about this new model that emerged in the wake of the war?
Yeah. This is the experience of the United States after World War II is a good example of what I referred to as fully realized hegemony. So this time around, it's not the sort of weak form of hegemony built mainly on economic power. It's also, it translates also at the political and military level. No, it's something. It's a form of hegemony that is far more institutionalized compared to the previous form of hegemony, and very importantly, it's also militarily cemented. No, and it's important to grasp all these different elements and this complex architecture of U.S. hegemony after World War II, in order to also to understand what happens afterwards. Now, maybe we have a chance to talk about that, but there you have many times this idea that the U.S. Entered very shortly afterwards into yet another crisis of U.S. hegemony. And there I argue that the U.S. developed the means to attempt to avoid such a crisis. Yeah.
There is a broad sense that in the 2007 financial recession, U.S. hegemony was finally threatened, and that China has in more recent years started moving in to take the place we're leaving empty. But you trace the hegemonic decline of the U.S. several decades previous and show that our hegemonic decline has been a much longer process and also involved advances made by other nations, especially Germany and Japan, who made tremendous strides starting in the 1980s, which forced the U.S. into a much weaker, more competitive stance. Can you give us a sense of this, where you're trying to rethink this decline and stretch it a bit farther back?
Yeah, I mean, what you have there is a big debate, you know, starting from the 1970s on whether the U.S. entered into a crisis of hegemony or not, right? And you have different positions. On the one hand, the idea that no, it's not the case. The U.S. Continued with hegemony, though with some transformations. Another who claim no, the U.S. entered already a crisis of hegemony. I tend to argue, actually, that the U.S. didn't enter into a crisis of hegemony starting from the 1970s, exactly because, as I said before, they had the means to maintain their hegemonic position. With that, I also break with that idea I started to outline at the beginning of the interview, that crises do not need to lead to necessarily to lead to a crisis or economic crisis, don't need to lead to a crisis of hegemony, especially when a state has the capabilities and capacities to maintain its hegemonic position. And this is, I believe, what happened. I mean, some argue that hegemony basically disappeared as such, even as a concept, that it wasn't, that it doesn't make sense to speak about hegemony because competition between different national states has disappeared and so on. So I believe that's not the case. Competition between national states is still something very relevant if we want to understand the the world economy. At the same time, I believe that the U.S. was able to block, to some extent, the ascent of competitors such as Germany or Japan, no, which were they were making advances in economic terms and so on. But given the sort of architecture that the United States constructed after World War II, they were not able to translate those sort of economic advances into the construction of hegemonic relations. Mm-hmm. So this is why I believe, or I try to expose that the U.S. Did not enter into a crisis after the economic crisis of the 1970s. At the same time, I also argue that we slowly start, not already in the 1970s, later on, when we analyze the rise of China, it's interesting because it occurs, I argue, outside U.S. hegemonic relations. So while the U.S. were able to block the ascent and the establishment of regional, say, hegemonies in both in Germany and Japan, it wasn't able to do that with China, exactly because it developed outside hegemonic relations.
Yeah, finally turning to the 2007 fiscal crisis, you actually, in a way, take the beginning of that crisis back to around 2005 with decelerated growth for housing prices, which then spiraled in a number of stages with different countries responding in different ways. And you then connect this back to the tendency of the rate of profit to fall. So can you unpack how you understand this crisis?
Yeah, also in this case, I attempt to integrate these different crisis theories, right? Again, I mean, as in the case of the Great Depression, you have different Marxists arguing that it was an under-consumptionist crisis with low wages that led to high indebtedness and so on. Or relatedly, that it was a crisis of overproduction or theories that argue for the increase of or the enormous increase of the financial sphere, and even talk about, say, financialized capitalism and so on. Then you have others who say, no, it's just the profitability or the rate of profit. So what I, again, attempt to do is to integrate these different aspects. And so what I argue is that attempting to exit the crisis of the 1970s and so on, the system or the capitalist world economy builds up different contradictions, which are, in fact, I mean, the analysis of financialization is one of those, inequality is one of those, low wages or flat wages or decreasing wages are another important element, not that characterize, well, say, neoliberalism or the exit of the way in which capitalism tried to overcome the crisis of the 1970s. And so how to relate all these problems? I say, okay, these different problems or contradictions are indeed related to profitability in the sense that the enormous increase of assets, financial assets, etc., becomes problematic when profitability relative to the growth of those assets remains low. So you can even argue, even if profitability rises, but not as fast or not as rapidly as it would be needed to sustain all this financial bubble, then you have a problem, okay? And actually, I mean, and even there you have this debate how far profitability grew, whether that's a problem or not. So I try to focus always in relative terms. But I believe that it did calculate, or not I believe, I mean, I saw interesting calculations that show that the rate of profit, even if it recovered a little bit, it never reached the stage that it had, say, after World War II. So it was low profitability. But always, I repeat, compared to the growth of the financial sphere, or compared to the disequilibria that we have related to, for example, inequality. So this is, again, the way in which I try to integrate these different crisis theories.
Yeah, with that, that kind of brings us through most of the book. I'm wondering if we can just go a little beyond what you wrote. We're currently on what is possibly the tail end of the COVID epidemic, although some parts of the world are still struggling, of course. But I just want to kind of ask how you see the last year functioning potentially as a sort of hegemonic crisis. Obviously, it threatened public health in a huge way, but it also, the danger brought to the surface a lot of underlying economic antagonisms that were already present. And then a little beyond that, there's also, I see a lot of people, particularly on the left, wondering if we are kind of on the tail end of neoliberalism in some way, if that crisis kind of forced that phase of capitalism on its way out. I recognize you may not have like a super fleshed out answer here, but I'm just wondering if I could get your thoughts on kind of how this last year functioned as a crisis and what are maybe some signposts we should be looking for that it actually forces some sort of hegemonic transition, even if we don't know yet if it actually will.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, many thanks for this question. As I said at the beginning, in every crisis, you have many talks about crisis of hegemony and the hegemonic transitions, in particular related, of course, to the rise of China and so on. And then many times you have, this is it, no? This is now the final or the final crisis of U.S. hegemony and so on, no? And I'm, as I try to demonstrate throughout this book, economic crisis, there's no automatism that they lead to a crisis of hegemony at the international level. If you read the press, it's interesting because a year ago, everybody was saying, okay, it's really the crisis of U.S. hegemony. China is actually even sending airplanes to the U.S. with aid, no, medical aid, also to other countries and so on. And now, 1 year afterwards, with the election of Biden and so on, what you read in the press is completely different, okay? You say, okay, the U.S. is again asserting itself. It is building its alliances again in Europe, also in the Far East, etc., to attempt to contain the rise of China. And so I believe that one needs to be careful. So for one thing, I would say that those analyses that are mainly built on Gramsci, for example, neo-Gramsci analysis, that actually maintain that we are in a war, well, that we entered after 1970, a war that goes beyond national states, has a problem in analyzing what is going on. So I think that what we are seeing is a reaffirmation of the importance of national states when we analyze and the competition between national states when we analyze the world economy. And I think that this COVID crisis is actually going towards making the states even more important and more assertive at the international level. So there is talk about the control of specific industries. You cannot leave the specific production of specific and important goods to international competition and so on. So you have to control those. And this is building, again, some, one would say, blocks, okay? So I'm, to summarize, I would say that the crisis might lead to perhaps indeed a crisis of U.S. hegemony, but understood in terms of, as I said, or defined as a situation in which you have another state that is able to construct hegemonic relations, at least at the international, at least at the regional level. And that would be, in this case, China, perhaps. So there is a strong conflict going on. But to speak about the hegemonic transition, I wouldn't say that that's a far more long and complex process. Okay. Unfortunately, this increased geopolitical competition is something that might create, lead to a period of more intense, at least political competition and even military in some parts of the of the world economy, I think. When it comes to neoliberalism and so on, I believe that, okay, there is a problem with the legitimacy of neoliberalism that we might express with a concept. I take again from Gramsci, which is the concept of the organic crisis. And this is when civil society basically detaches itself from the state or political society, when subordinated classes stop believing in what leaders are saying, what the normal form of maintaining the consent of the population is not working in the usual manner. And this opens a very difficult situation. Again, it's not automatic that this leads to something more progressive or so. Well, we know, in the US with Trump, in Italy, in Brazil, in lots of different places, okay, with an important increase, for example, of the far right. No, so this can also lead to this sort of situations. And whether this lack of legitimacy that neoliberalism is leaving will indeed lead to its supersession, I think it's a very open question. I mean, in hegemony plays an also at the international level plays an important role. The U.S. have the capacity to print money, have expensive programs and so on. This is not the case for all countries, okay? In some subordinated countries, you could have even a problem of over-indebtedness, which might lead, again, to practices that we usually associate with neoliberalism. Again, cuts in public spending, in wages, and so forth. No? So we have to differentiate, I think, also when we talk about the end or not of neoliberalism, of the different countries, the different situations, and so on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you very much for your thoughts on that. So as a final question, we always like to ask, what, if anything, are you working on now? Do you have any new projects you're developing or just directions you're researching in?
Yeah, I'm actually, I have two. One is a more a short-term project which I'm working on with our political economy research group at the Universidad Autónoma Metropolitana, and we are basically working on Marx's general law of capitalist accumulation. It's an important law in Marx's Capital, but we noticed that when you look at the literature, or at least the recent literature, it's not something that academia, not only academia, has considered enough. So this is what we are working on at the moment, and we are working on a book, a collected work with the different essays on that subject. And I'm also working on another project that attempts basically to make somehow a step backward with the work I have been presenting today. And I'm looking at different possible reasons for why some states are able to break hegemonic relations, existing hegemonic relations, and finally, or possibly, rise and develop as a great power or a hegemonic state. And in doing that, I am basically looking at revolution. So I analyze, say, the revolution in China as something important that enabled China to develop outside U.S. hegemonic relations. Or I'm even looking at the U.S. Revolution for Independence and the Civil War as a way in which the U.S. actually was able to break with hegemonic relations, in this case with related to Great Britain and so on, and then to rise as a hegemonic power. So this is what I'm looking at and working on at the moment.
Yeah, excellent. You've got a lot of really good stuff in the works, it sounds like. So Lorenzo Fusaro, thank you so much for being with us.
Well, thanks to you. Many thanks for giving me this opportunity.